Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. This is show 280, Autonomy Through Agorism, Part 1. And let me tell you a little bit about what's going to be happening here in the coming shows. This is a series that I originally envisioned as a three-parter. I'm going to be joined by a listener named Jamin, who's out in Western Pennsylvania, and we're going to talk about his permaculture operation and the larger picture, of course, of agorism. But there's a lot of people who are participating in the counter economy, doing a lot of exciting things, and the series could expand beyond just these three parts. So I'm certainly open to suggestions for guests or topics, because my discussion so far with Jamin has been really helpful and really inspiring. There's a lot of great stories here. And obviously, since we're talking about autonomy through agorism, that's a continuing theme on this show, trying to develop independence in as many areas as possible to, at the very least, defend ourselves against a system that is encouraging dependence, right? So this is important that we keep hitting this topic as far as I'm concerned. Now, certainly, this is not realistic for every listener right now, going out and getting, you know, a half an acre, 5 acres of your own land and starting a sustainable living operation. I certainly understand that. It's not realistic for me right now. But the more ways we can find independence, the better. And we should be talking about it. And there's also a lot of young people who listen to this show, which is great. And the more time they have to think and plan, well, the better off they are. You know, who knows what will be possible in 5 years. So I really want to get as much information as I can out about this subject, because I think that agorism, permaculture, DIY, these are things not taught in school. Therefore, these are ideas that I am embracing and that I want to spread. That I, in my little personal life, want to find as many ways to implement as many of these things as possible in the near future. And I hope you're inspired by this as well. I hope you find these shows valuable. And I look forward to your feedback and suggestions. Thank you so much for listening. And before we begin, if you are unfamiliar with these two concepts that we are going to be discussing in the upcoming shows, I want to provide some quick working definitions of agorism and permaculture. I would also direct your attention back to podcast episodes 249 and 250B. One features John Bush, the other features my friend Brian, and the topics of permaculture and agorism are discussed in those shows as well. So let's start with agorism, and for that we go to the Mises.org wiki. Agorism is the practice of counter-economics and the ideas associated with that practice. Agorist ideas assert that libertarian philosophy occurs in practice, in the real world, as counter-economics. It was first introduced by libertarian philosopher Samuel Edward Konkin III in 1975. Although very similar to anarcho-capitalism, agorism is explicitly opposed to political elections and parliamentary strategies. Some agorists oppose intellectual property. Some allow for certain forms of intellectual property. Many anarcho-capitalists and voluntarists are practicing agorists. There is no definitive policy statement from any authoritative leader of agorism because agorism is decentralized and non-hierarchical by definition. Agorism, based on the principle of counter-economics, promotes withdrawing from the state and using counter-economic activities to minimize what a person contributes to the state in the form of taxes, license fees, and so forth. And Konkin derived the term from classical Greek. The agora means an open place for assembly and market. Now, permaculture, which we're going to discuss today in greater detail, is simply the development of agricultural ecosystems intended to be sustainable and self-sufficient. So with that out of the way, here we go. Enjoy. Enjoy. So, Jamin, how you doing?
All right. How are you doing, Brett?
Good. And you are going to be joining me for probably as many as three shows to discuss what you described as your journey to reclaim autonomy, primarily through agorism. But one of the things that we're going to be focusing on is how permaculture, something that we've talked about on School Sucks before, fits into that bigger picture. In the upcoming shows, we're going to tell you your whole story, what your family has been through in this process over the last many, many years, learning your way through this and evolving and getting to where you are now. And I really, really look forward to that. Also, we are going to discuss probably in our concluding conversation how this subject of permaculture relates not only to voluntarism, which we'll probably be discussing throughout all of our conversations, but also NVC, the trivium, and the concept of living purposefully. So today, I thought the best place for us to start, as far as groundwork is concerned, is why would somebody want to do this?
Oh, definitely. I would say the motivation is just, you know, realizing everything is not what it seems. You know, this actually ties it into education because I went to a pretty demented school, let's say.
Sure, I believe you.
It was a small town. You know, we always tease that it's stuck in the 1950s. And they were just completely unapologetic about grooming us to be Walmart employees, basically.
What,
I mean,
really?
We even had an we had an assembly once when Walmart was moving into town. You know, the whole administration, the principal and superintendent were talking to us how if we do good that we can get into Walmart. And, you know, just this crazy low expectations for, you know, everybody in that school. And my eyes were kind of opened just from having an old right, now we'd call him maybe a paleoconservative grandpa.
Sure.
That would rant and rave about property rights being violated and was very active in trying to get stuff done about it. You know, the typical letters to the congressman and the governor and newspaper editorials. And he actually got a decent-sized following for his... He did, you know, like the cassette tape podcast thing where he was sending them out.
Yep.
And being an introvert and just liking to take apart stuff and put it back together and everything like that, I would just be super interested in everything the guy had to say. And it was also logical and it made so much sense. And basically that started opening my eyes a little bit. I mean, this is around, I want to say maybe fourth or fifth grade.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He had the, let's say, you know, I guess it has evolved into Tea Party, constitutionalist, let's take back the government with the militia type thing. I had that attitude for quite a while. So, you know, I was basically an anarchist at heart, but I had all these minarchist ideas around me as the ways to change what was wrong.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it took into, you know, just a few years ago to really shed every last bit of that minarchism and, you know, embrace voluntarism as the standard that we need to try to achieve.
Yeah. Now, your story, obviously, as far as the work you're doing at home and with your family, was certainly taking place long before that final transformation, right?
Oh, definitely. I've kind of gone through a lot of ideas. You know, I guess being introduced to Chomsky in probably like 99 or something,
yeah,
was really, you know, ironically, kind of my start in the hunger for knowledge for libertarian theory and whatnot. And mm-hmm. just the explanations, especially, I mean, his views on U.S. foreign policy and, you know, a lot of the historical revisionism that he's basically parroting from other people, but he was talking about kind of started me on my track, philosophical anarchism or libertarianism, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
Much in the same way that you say that Zen did for you.
Yeah, it was really both of those guys at the same time. I don't remember how exactly it happened, but I found them pretty close together. And I was saying, who was I talking to recently? Ben Stone. There was nothing more exciting and motivating to find out that the wool had been pulled over my eyes, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So that's what really motivated me to start exploring. I have to give those guys a lot of credit. But go on. I don't want to go off on a tangent about that. So.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, well, in high school, I would almost call myself like a proto-anarchist.
Yeah.
You know, but I actually leaned toward syndicalism because I was economically illiterate, like everybody else in school.
So can you just define that for the people who are unfamiliar with...
Well, I mean, syndicalism is basically, you know, your worker-owned companies, you know, all the workers own the capital of the company, and it doesn't take into account a lot of things,
yeah.
I mean, to say the least. Now, I think the whole system couldn't work that way, but I'm sure syndicalist companies could be competitive in their own way, depending on the other market pressures around them and stuff. But, I mean, it was basically a knee-jerk anti-authority reaction for me, seeing, you know, especially like some of my early jobs and just realizing what we were being groomed for in school.
Yeah.
Now, I never have trusted state power. I mean, that's just always been a given to me that, you know, I could never square the circle or whatever about the whole, you know, we need a government of people because people might do bad things, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Circular logic. But, you know, I had a fair amount of cognitive dissonance because I was still a constitutionalist. That was just more from programming. You know, that's, to me, that is a relief valve for the system. You know, and there's many, you know, there's many gatekeepers that will steer you different ways. So you know, it still keeps you in the current paradigm or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but they will steer you from being into the whole Patriot movement from the mid-90s and like seeing what the local scene of that was like.
Yeah.
And then completely rejecting it because of that.
Yeah. The culture that comes with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's pretty much why I didn't continue, you know, along that path and everything else and just went separate ways from that whole thing. And
yeah.
I guess those illusions were slowly being dissolved at, you know, at that point when I realized, you know, what it was really all about and who the people in it were and a lot of their ulterior motives, at least the ones I came in contact with. And it's all your standard stuff that even the left tries to use as scare tactics. You know, the best lie is mostly truth with a little bit of twist at the end.
So racism, bigotry, that kind of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a strong element of... I don't know if you're familiar with the Christian identity movement.
No. I'd like to hear more about it.
Oh, geez, dude. They're, you know, every non-white race is like some spawn of Satan, like some type of mud golem. It's right up there with alien lizard Jews and stuff. I mean, hey, maybe the initiates believe that too. Who knows? But, you know.
Why not?
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's. I think what you're speaking to is that there's a real challenge. Once you start to... Michael Dean, in our recent conversation, actually had a story that reminds me of this idea, that once you start to realize what the problems are, or that there are problems, let's say, because what the problems are, that might come long after. There's a lot of different groups that are competing for your mind and possibly
yeah.
your time and your labor and your money. Like, hey, come with us. Be one of us. And these, and it's usually about scapegoating or finding somebody in some group, casting them as the villain. So it's a difficult, once you realize that there is a lot wrong, there is still quite a maze in front of you, I think, to get to what I firmly believe from years of research is the best and most fulfilling philosophy, which is, you know, lucky for us where we are where we are now.
Oh, yeah.
So I understand that. And as I was reading your story, you know, and going through all of the operations that you have going on at your home, I was doing that last night. And then I woke up this morning and I was working on editing my next show with Thaddeus Russell. And towards the end of the show, I really asked him to clarify what he meant by work, right? And
yeah.
and this idea that, you know, what just comes across in kind of a cursory examination as work is for suckers, you know, work is for Puritans. And, you know, I'd read your story the night before, and I'm like, well, he must work all the time. You know, he must be working constantly. So what I eventually got out of Thaddeus was that there's work that is fulfilling and that accomplishes a lot of the goals that we're going to talk about in our upcoming conversations. But then there's work for the sake of work, which is what most people are doing. And that really is very much the opposite of sustainable living. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on that. And I know you had commented a couple of times on threads related to those shows that I'd done with Thaddeus. So, you know, what do you have to say about that whole subject of work and your relationship with it and what it means to you?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I see that as a very narrow way to look at being productive.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy everything that I do.
Yep.
You know, and I enjoy it way more than I would enjoy just sitting around doing stuff that just is immediate gratification that doesn't accomplish anything.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that in my life, and that's a bottomless pit. That's not really living. I think if I'm not figuring something out, or if I'm not designing something or building something or parenting or doing any of the things I do, I don't feel fulfilled. My needs aren't met. I have a need to do all those things. And I think it's really myopic to look at all labor as something that's undesirable. I even like to dig ditches because
yeah.
I like to be very physically fit. And if I'm not digging ditches and moving heavy wheelbarrows and doing gardening and, you know, lifting heavy things and stuff like that, I'm swinging kettlebells or, you know, deadlifting barbells or something.
Right.
So it's just, I actually like it for the variety in my physical fitness training. Many people would make the argument that, well, they would rather go to the gym and do whatever at the gym to accomplish the same type of ends, but they would see that as some type of, you know, recreation,
mm-hmm.
whereas I'm accomplishing the same thing and being productive.
Right.
So it's like, I really think it's very much a false choice to do you want to work or do you want to play? You know, it's the whole thing that we're trying to do, both Karen and I, is we're trying to make our work our play and our play our work.
Yeah.
So there's no transition. And I think that's what the best term I can use is maybe libertines. I don't know. It's so hard. All these terms have so much definition wobble.
Yeah.
I think it misses the forest for the trees sometimes. You know, just like, you know, I almost think of it as your Puritan is always worried that somewhere somebody is having fun. While your pure libertine is always worried that somewhere somebody is deferring gratification.
Yeah.
It's such a false dichotomy to me. And, you know, I think reality and my happiness lies really in the middle of all that. As long as what I'm doing is fulfilling to me, I can do it all day. I mean, that has to do with my personality, but, I mean, I just get really into my work. If I didn't have all this stuff to do, I wouldn't know what to do with myself.
Sure. So one of the first things that we wanted to talk about in answering the question, why would somebody want to go through all of this effort? Well, your answer is that these efforts will be rewarded. Just like if it would be insane for somebody to go to the gym and lift weights if it never produced any positive benefit, appearance or health-wise or strength-wise. That would just be the behavior of a maniac
if it
had no positive benefit. So as I'm trying to think about how we could discuss the rewards of this effort, well, obviously there's an economic reward that we can get into. There's a psychological and emotional reward. There's probably rewards in our relationships, but also there's larger rewards as far as the whole philosophy of liberty is concerned, right? So we can start wherever you want. If you want to start with the economics of this, that would be great.
Sure. I mean, the economics of this is a vast thing. You can't really determine the price of food. You can't really determine, I'm talking true cost, I'm not talking cost and fake money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people miss that aspect of things when they're on like calculation to form their preferences in their heads. They're weighing the cost of things monetarily more than the hidden costs of things. You know, the what is not seen in the whole equation.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that a lot with people that are very focused on economics. Like, I've had many discussions with people very focused in economics that tell me what I'm doing is silly because it violates the concept of specialization.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see it that way. Specialization, as far as I'm concerned, is another continuum. technology has allowed us to be relatively specialized if we wish to be. But there are still things that we do on our own just because those are things that people do to live. You know, you don't have somebody put your clothes on you in the morning. You don't have someone brush your teeth. I mean, you know, most people, you know.
Well, you know, there's this interesting thing, too, this messy circle that they tell us from a very early age. No, they didn't tell us this ever. But there was a time in my adult life where I thought it was good advice to be a specialist, to be an expert at something because it makes you marketable. So now we have people who are, because, I mean, eventually the word got out. Like in high school, they used to say, oh, you know, keep your options open. Look at this broad educational spectrum that we're covering here. So, you know, you can have all these choices of what you want to do. And there's some truth to that. But eventually, if it comes down to like a high income, obviously, yes, it's good advice in many cases to fit into the existing economic structures, if that's a priority of somebody's, to specialize. So specialization leads to more work, which leads to a higher income, which leads to more resources to be able to afford specialists for all the things you don't know how to do.
Yes, exactly. And that the problem becomes that we're being held captive.
Mm-hmm.
The more we contribute to our own enslavement is, to me, a net negative. You can only be as specialized as you can today in this present system because of all the externalities that are forcing down on you and all these systems that basically are plugged into systems of domination.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a firm believer, like you had Ben Stone on, he was talking a little bit how the market, you know, there needs to be a market for liberty. Well, that's part of what the market for liberty is to realize that if you can take back little pieces of your autonomy by starting to do some things yourself, that is the market force. And if you can inspire other people to do the same, that's just going to help create that market.
Mm-hmm.
To me, turning that type of stuff over to other people in a system that we have just gives them power over you. Just gives the system power over you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a firm believer in the role of farming in the creation of the state, and that when surplus food was able to be grown, and that created the, let's say, market pressure for the state to move in.
Yeah.
And control it. And I think being resilient and able to take that back is something substantial, and it'll be a substantial blow to the state. So as far as how that could be at odds with specialization, I don't really see it that way at all. The whole context isn't seen with that view, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
The whole context of everything are all the pressures and all the external forces that are in control of you when you don't have control of the basic elements of life,
mm-hmm.
and which can be seen in so many different civilizations, that when the power of food is taken away from the people and put in the hands of the oligarchy, it's more damaging than many of the other powers, including the power of self-defense being taken away.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, there are so many variables, but food is probably, you know, the most essential. And I would say, if people really thought about it, what would weigh most heavily on their minds? But it's interesting to think about what would change, you know, especially in times of public panic or widespread economic panic. If everybody just had a yard full of food, what kind of a calming effect would that have, right? And it's just an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. Another thing is that what I'm trying to do, and what a lot of what other permaculture and sustainable agriculture people are trying to do, is come up with systems that take a very minimum amount of input, be it input labor, input materials, anything that goes into the system can be seen as input, like systems that take a very small amount of time a day to keep going that produce a yield that is substantial.
Mm-hmm. So
that's the full context that is not being seen with that argument, is that there are people developing these systems to make it so you can still be highly specialized and still have time to be autonomous in these very important aspects of any biological entity's existence, is, you know, making sure it has food.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very much a middle ground between forgetting specialization altogether and living some ascetic lifestyle like the Amish or something. You know, what a lot of people don't realize about the Amish is they do things the way they do things because it's so labor intensive.
What do you mean? That's interesting.
Well, they have a very similar, you know, it's kind of taken to an extreme, but they have a similar idea as to what we were talking about, how work can be play and such. But they very much want to balance how much they produce versus how much work they have. And they want to balance it in a completely different way. What they want is they want all their time to be consumed by doing this stuff and be sustainable in doing it. Like, they're not looking for the easier way to plant their crops. They're not looking for much easier things unless that is what's required to keep afloat in this economy.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why do you think they want that? You said they want all their time filled.
It's the Puritan work ethic.
Okay, that's what I thought you were getting at. I just wanted to make sure.
It's the old, you know, the old school version of the Puritan work ethic is a lot of the reasons why they won't modernize. That is a very poor thing to compare what permaculture people are doing to, because myself, I seek to minimize the input at all points. If I can minimize the input, it's, you know, if I can make things take an hour less a day by just implementing some element of design, for instance, with irrigation, and there's, you know, so many other little techniques that permaculturists use to eliminate labor and input and stuff like that, then I can basically have that time as free time or devoted to another project or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out freedom does require work, especially in this world.
Oh, yeah.
And that's freedom in our work, freedom in our relationships, freedom in ourselves. But we do want to be free with respect to time once in a while, I would think. I certainly do.
Oh, definitely. And, I mean, that's really why I'm bringing the Amish up, is that seems like the type of straw man that's created when these conversations happen.
Okay.
Is if people were doing what you want to do, all they do all day is work, and they wouldn't have any time to do this, and they wouldn't have any time for specialization, and, you know, everybody would be poverty-stricken. Basically, if you look through Mises.org, I think it's on there. Murray Rothbard actually wrote an article condemning self-sufficiency for all the reasons I'm talking about, and he uses this Indian model as an example, and it's the same type of thing where it's very labor-intensive. I mean, it's not anything like people like myself are trying to design at all. I mean, it's night and day. Yeah, I totally agree that if, you know, you can't be in a modern economy and everybody just be farmers that work their field all day and, you know, come home and go to sleep and get up in the morning and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd really like to make that distinction between the whole puritanical and antiquated methods that require all this input. I mean, a lot of these methods are built on false premises that if you would go back to the premise and start over, you could redesign the system so it was a lot less labor intensive.
Right, right.
We want minimum input for the maximum yield. We want to design systems that people can actually live with and not totally take over their lives taken care of. You know, we want it to be as easy to grow food as it is to wash your dishes.
Yeah.
I mean, and saying that you can't wash your dishes because of, you know, it violates the concept of specialization, you know, people would look at you funny. You know,
right.
That's what we're trying to do, at least. What I'm doing is reconciles violation of specialization, I guess.
Sure. And what you're saying is, like, hence the word sustainable.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And self-sustaining.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it makes a lot more sense to put more resources into, let's say, a garden bed using one of these alternative methods that are very high yield and low input after you establish them, so you can just plant and harvest every year. That you don't have to be working the soil, you don't have to have the heavy equipment, all designing away the labor.
Yeah, yeah.
So, for instance, I was talking about the garden bed situation.
Mm-hmm.
You could get a rototiller and some chemical amendments, you know, petrochemicals, in the form of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, and you could till up the patch, and you could put those amendments on there, and you could grow something, a fairly impressive crop or whatever, for that growing season.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to do it again.
Yeah.
And then you have to do it again. And not only that, is that whole method of tilling actually burns up the nutrients in the soil as fast as you're putting them on. So that's why they have to keep adding so many amendments. A good analogy would be a fire. It's like a fire. The soil microbes, when aerated with all that oxygen from tilling, it's just like stoking a fire. They basically burn up most of the macronutrients in the soil, and then you have to keep adding them. And what happens is when you're adding those petrochemical-based nutrients, you're actually destroying the natural nutrient pathways that are used to break down the quote-unquote organic nutrients and make them available to the plants. So you're just perpetuating this thing, and you're losing topsoil, and you're also creating hard pan under what you're growing, which is basically like compacted soil that roots have a very hard time penetrating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the repetitive beating of the tines and the heavy equipment rolling over the fields, and to the point where, if you drive around people's fields here, like the conventional farmers, they're all clay. There's no living soil. They look like my subsoil. They're whole fields. And with all the other issues that we're facing with just the issues surrounding petroleum use,
mm-hmm.
and how that's unsustainable on a lot of levels. I mean, I'm not a full-blown peak oil type person, because I've yet to see data that proves that, but it's something that we don't know the true cost of. It's like one of the main things with the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And also, you know, an exponent is all the resource wars that go on around the world. That's not added in at the pump. That's taken out at tax time.
Sure.
That's taken out of the future productivity of future generations. I mean, we don't know how much it costs to fill up a tractor, to roll it across the field, to till it. Now, we know how many dollars it costs, but is that, you know, that's no, in no way the full context.
Right. I mean, I think the most important thing is that it's a controlled resource, right? So even if oil is abiotic and it's just infinite within the earth and regenerates itself, and most of what people have thought about it for a long time turns out to be wrong, at least in the current political context, it's going to be controlled, which means that if you depend on it, you have less freedom.
Exactly. And if you depend on it to sustain your life as a biological organism, that could turn into a bad thing really easily.
Which almost everybody does in one way or another, even though we don't think about it that way. It's very, very, very true that, you know, most people would be dead in a week if national transportation shut down.
Oh, definitely. The just-in-time food system is a travesty waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was, you know, I've always, you know, had a, I guess, prepper-type mentality, and, you know, I've always thought it's a very good idea to have some backup plans, and when I was working a regular job, I was a systems analyst, and part of that is always having a backup plan. It's not paranoid to back your data up and keep it in a separate building. The backup concept is one of resilience.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely something you gain by doing this.
It's sure.
An amount of resilience that you wouldn't have normally.
So we were talking about this, what did you call it, just-in-time food delivery system?
Yes.
So I thought that would be a good place to maybe transition into discussing some of the economic rewards of doing this. Obviously, you spend significantly less money at a grocery store and less time invested in doing that. But are you guys to a point where there are, you know, once a month trip to the grocery store, twice a week? Do you have a percent of independence that you're at, that you're working towards?
Well, we basically have been doing it a piece at a time.
Mm-hmm.
One of our main things we still buy at the store all the time is milk.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any dairy animals yet. That is something that we want to fix, but we need some more infrastructure, specifically some more fencing and a barn that isn't condemnable to accomplish that. But we typically will go to the grocery store maybe once a week. But, you know, most of the stuff we've been buying at the grocery store has just been additional things. And now we've just really got into the meat production.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to change a lot. Like, I have a freezer full of chickens now, and I have, like, 6 rabbits ready to harvest now, and a litter of piglets. So the meat situation, if we decide to feed all these out and or grow them out, we could definitely provide for our meat.
Mm-hmm.
We typically provide for all of our calorie, like main calorie crops like potatoes. Like, we still have a couple crates full of potatoes left from last year's harvest in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't buy those. You know, it's like you replace an item at a time. And we're only a few years at this current property. So there's a lot of systems that we've started that take a few years to get into production.
Sure.
You know, we've already done the work as far as we have a lot of fruit and a lot of perennial vegetables that we've got going here. And basically, in the next couple years, that will all come into production, emanating more stuff that we buy.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2 or 3 years, we will definitely be to your, you know, once a month grocery store trip. And that grocery store will probably be to get extra stuff, you know, basically the ice cream, so to speak, and, you know, stopping at the feed store on the way.
Sure,
and
yeah.
With the long-term plan, being able to provide all the feed for the animals on site, that is the next horizon, because we are buying animal feed for the most part. I mean, we free-range our chickens, and we tractor our chickens, but we do supplement with store-bought feed. And there is no such thing as organic feed where we are. It's like it doesn't exist. People look at you weird when you ask at the feed store.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we're not feeding the best stuff, but our animals are very healthy. Like, the quality of our eggs is still, it's much better than even the organic ones at least the ones we buy at, we were buying at our local place for like $4.50 a dozen. The yolks in our eggs are true free-range yolks. They're the deep orange with lots of flavor.
Mm.
They're bound to have a much higher essential fatty acid, like omega-3 content from the free-ranging.
Mm-hmm.
I do plant crops for the chickens. Like, last year, I planted a big patch of turnips in the yard for the chickens, and they have just now demolished them. So from last fall, they had greens and turnips almost all winter, except when it was covered with ice. It's a long-winded answer to your question, but it's a piecemeal type approach. And with the ultimate goal of having surplus to sell and barter and contribute to the local counter economy.
And that actually leads to my next question. We talked about this a little bit, and I had a couple questions about some of the language that you used. And I think we're on the same page here, but obviously, having come from you know, different roots, like I had you know, left-wing political roots, which we discussed a little bit, and you,
yeah,
you know, allied yourself for a while with the Patriot movement or the militia movement. And in all of those mindsets, there's this persistent idea that you're fighting someone. And
yeah,
one of the things that was really helpful for me was to get over the idea that I was fighting the state, you know, because I'm not. And I don't really think about it too much. What I'm trying to do, I believe, through my work, is show people alternatives to systems where the state currently has a monopoly, and to show people an alternative philosophy to the prevailing ideology. And that's my role. And that I think I said this in the conversation with Ben, that, yeah, the state will, you know, take care of itself eventually, and all these systems. So one of the appeals I really think about what you're doing is the agorism, right? Like, trying to create this counter economy is so important in the furthering of these ideas.
Oh, definitely. There has to be an option there for people to choose. If you want them to choose, you know, for their own autonomy, there has to be options there to take the place of the monopoly systems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know there's a large amount of mindshare amongst the liberty community that seeks to do that above board through the coerced market and just become wealthy and, you know, buy your Galt's Gulch and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is only perpetuating things. I think the most productivity that you can draw out of, I call it the false economy, the less sustainable they can be. The less sustainable the false economy can be when you're drawing all these resources out of it.
Yeah.
Does that kind of
explain?
And as far as the other elements of agorism go, I really am into the idea of open source as a way of organizing. And agorism is very open source. Basically, you have people doing these in permaculture, too. And for me, permaculture is a method of agorism. So, I mean, I might even use them synonymously. I think that permaculture and agorism is a way to create that alternative with not only the food system, but if you do permaculture and you're selling food and you're selling, you know, your surplus and you're accepting alternative currency, that's like an exponent to how effective what you're doing is as a revolutionary act.
Yeah. Have you thought about ways, or have you spent any time, because there's a lot of people who have the resources to do this, right? And there's a lot of people who would agree with a lot of what you have to say, you know, about the state or about the current prevailing problems that also have the resources to do this. But either they would go to the specialization is better argument, or another one that I see is, you know, kind of, you brought it up and you addressed it, like tying this in with Amish lifelessness. Like, it's cool to go out. And it is cool to go out once in a while. But that's, you know, this would be seen as somebody who's given up pleasure in life. And I think we've addressed most of those things. But have you had any experience or success with trying to sell the merits of this to, you know, either libertarians or just ordinary people that you come across in the community?
Oh, sure. Sure. We actually volunteer at a local community garden.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of the garden is, you know, they don't really have a lot of knowledge on what they're doing. They're kind of new to the whole thing. We come, we bring all these ideas, and we kind of get an audience gathered around us because we're explaining, you know, how to do things, different obstacles and how they can be overcome, and, you know, trying to explain the nuances of doing different techniques and stuff. And we have a lot of interest. I've had a lot of just all through my life, and, you know, Karen as well. Karen is just as much a part of this and into this as I am. She, being a visiting nurse, she interacts with a lot of people in a pretty wide socioeconomic spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of spreading the philosophy of what we're doing that way. Granted, it's very a status-friendly approach she uses, and just basically talking about gardening and everything else.
But yeah.
It might be surprising to some how many people would like to do this. I believe there's a very strong drive in a lot of people to do something like this, and even if the philosophy isn't understood, just the whole being able to control, have more control over what you put in your body,
mm-hmm.
and not rely on a third party.
Yeah.
To, you know, arbitrate what's in your food. And we really approach it from that angle, and it has a very broader audience. And I try to sneak the autonomy stuff in. I've, like, engaged with a lot of the people we've met through doing that, and even, like, friended them on Facebook and everything. And as it turns out, my page is a little too much for a lot of those people. And
sure.
I think maybe one of them is still my friend or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, even two of the people that unfriended me still are very interested in what I have to say when I go help out there.
Yeah.
So as far as, like, let's say liberty-minded people, I've met a lot of people that are already doing this. And I've met a lot of people that are just starting, a lot of people that are thinking about it, a lot of people that are neck deep in doing it. And I think what we're doing has inspired a lot of the people who are on the fence to do something. Yeah, at least I'd like to think that, and it seems so from the response I've got from the stuff I post. Yeah, I started a Facebook group, the Agora Ecola, mm-hmm. the Market and Farm, and I've had a pretty good, it's a closed group even, and I've had a pretty good response there. A friend of mine on there has a page called Sustainable Connection, and there seems to be a decent amount of interest sparked in these ideas there. So, I mean, the soil is fertile for this type of thing, and especially with these innovative processes, that does make it doable for people and still live the lifestyle they want to live and not live some aesthetic Puritan work ethic, you know, work all day and do it again type thing. Yeah. Like, even with all I do, most of my time during the day is spent hanging out with my kids and watching my kids and doing the things that don't require much concentration, because it's very, I'm the type of person, it's like all or nothing with concentration like that. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, Facebook is the perfect outlet for my activism, because I can give things, you know, 2-3 minutes focus before I'm interrupted and get something accomplished.
Sure. And I'm happy to hear that you're having some success, because one of the reasons why I initially became interested in this area and I wanted to talk about it more on the show. Now, obviously, of course, I would love to be in a situation where I could start doing this myself. There are a few factors that are getting in the way of that right now, but I'm hoping that will change in the future. And like I was saying, the appeal for me is that I'm certainly no stranger to the realization that we live in a society that inculcates and in many ways rewards dependence. And, you know, I think we can see that the state has tried to really over the last century, if not longer, hijack the family model, which is the ultimate power disparity in a human relationship. If the person who holds the power, a parent, you know, wants to exploit a child or take advantage of a child or abuse a child, that is the easiest relationship in which to do it. Right. So the state has in many ways over the course of the last century tried to mimic that relationship, to become the parent, to make dependents and then reward them for their dependency. And that's more than just people, you know, in inner cities and rural areas lining up for welfare. It's almost all of us in one way or another. And I was having a conversation recently. I was thinking it was on Free Talk Live, about state assistance for certain things. And in some cases, it's just we don't live in a world where if the right or the wrong things happen, you might just not have another option. You know, you might just not have another realistic option. And that kind of speaks to what you were saying about going in and playing the game. You're contributing, right? So everything is kind of putting you into this funnel where one way or another, you will contribute. Either you will pay in or you will take out, you know, given the right set of circumstances, or again, the unfortunate set of circumstances. So obviously, there's all kinds of very important emotional needs that living that life of dependency does not address and does not meet. So we have a need for autonomy, which you've spoken about throughout this conversation, and that's very important. I think we have a need for predictability in life and stability in life that is also very important that this addresses. But when it comes to speaking to the whole work issue, we also have a need for self-efficacy. And I would think that would be one of the most satisfying elements of doing this day in and day out, is to be able to see and experience the rewards of that work.
Oh, definitely. It's, you know, work takes on a whole new meaning when you're doing something that is completely intrinsically motivated and you're still getting extrinsic rewards for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it like doubles your motivation. When I see the product of my effort, like last year, I built a massive wood core keyhole garden bed.
Mm-hmm.
I completely lowballed how much labor that was going to be. You've probably seen pictures if you looked at my page, but it's massive. I mean, it's like 150 square feet of growing area, and it's probably 3 cords of wood. All together with the wood that's buried and the wood that's bordered. And to get the type of yield I got out of that the first year, which is like almost a sacrificial year for that system, it was so gratifying. And I mean, every time I ate, like, we had broccoli all year from that bed. We just kept, you know, broccoli is a sprouting variety that we have. You basically just harvest it and come back in a, you know, 3-4 days and you have more heads.
Mm-hmm.
But this patch of broccoli provided us all year, and the amount of gratification to get that return on that labor, and knowing that for probably, you know, if we're here another 20 years, that bed will still be productive like that.
Yeah.
And all we have to do is, you know, plant and harvest, and we use a method where we add a little bit of amendments while we're planting called fertile hole. It's simple as putting organic amendments in the hole you're going to put your soil block in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was extremely rewarding, and it totally vindicated all the labor I put into it, because I know that I have this super fertile place that's very convenient. When it gets going, it's just like going to the grocery store, you know, walking through the produce aisle. I have my own produce aisle in my yard that takes almost no effort now to be productive. When systems start working like that and everything starts paying off, like when you figure out something, for example, I'll keep on the broccoli here. A lot of permaculture is examining the relationship that things have with each other and kind of how to hack that and use it to your advantage. Okay, for an example with the broccoli, there is a pest on any cabbage-type plant called the cabbage worm or cabbage moth, cabbage lop, or whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
that's this little green worm, and it makes it extremely hard to grow any of the cabbage plants without using some type of pesticide, be it organic or chemical or whatever. And even organic pesticides have a long list of negatives because they negatively affect the entire ecosystem of your insects.
Mm-hmm.
It puts things out of balance and makes a situation that you become reliant on that. So through observation and study, but mostly observation for this particular thing, I noticed that the black and yellow wasps we have so prevalent here that most people view as a pest, that they along not only are a really good predatory insect, but they love broccoli worms or mm-hmm. cabbage loppers. So all I do for my broccoli for the pest control is I plant plants next to the broccoli that attract the wasps. And then once I see that the cabbage worms are out and about, all you have to do is squish a few of those and put it on the top of the broccoli leaves where it's very obvious to a flying insect. And as soon as your first wasp notices that, it will start patrolling with the rest of its brood. So you basically have this drone army of wasps patrolling, and what they do is they decapitate the worms when they see them and take the pieces away to feed their young with. So figuring that out and seeing that work and growing broccoli that maybe in a whole harvest you might find a handful of those worms on it, which is no big deal at all, versus when you are badly infested with them, you know, the broccoli is almost unedible because they're just everywhere. So it's, you know, the amount of gratification I got from that personally
right.
is just tremendous. And the same thing with, like, figuring out other things. Like, you've talked about hugelkultur before.
Yep.
Hugelkultur is something I came to on my own by just observing how well things were growing in this rotted wood. And at our previous property, we had a chunk of forest, a small chunk, but it had some nice downed hardwood trees that were basically completely disintegrated. And the fertility around those trees were just, it was just ridiculous. So I started taking buckets of that rotted wood and putting it at the bottom of, I was using raised tire beds at the time. And one of the key elements of hugelkultur is the rotted wood below things. I imagined that if I did that enough and had that wood through the whole bottom of the bed, it would make a capillary network of fungus that would wick nutrients around. And I had ridiculously fertile garden beds after I did that. You know, I find out later that that's a practice they've been using in Germany for like hundreds of years, and just figuring out the connections between those things and seeing it all work and, you know, eating the harvest from it.
Yeah.
Tremendously motivating.
You know, maybe that story of the worms versus the wasps, which was just really fascinating, maybe that helps us develop some sympathy, if we want to, for the people who try to control our society. The Rockefeller Education Board, the Tax-Free Foundation, the academia, think tanks, where they just like identify different groups and figure out how they can kind of use them against each other for their own benefit, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's satisfying for them. Maybe that makes them feel very efficacious. Now, I'm kidding. But that's what it I don't know why. Maybe I'm a cynic, but that's what popped up in my mind when you're pitting the worms against the wasps.
That's a very, very relevant connection to make. You know, I look at designing these systems as like the advanced practice of using natural law. You know, you have your set variables and you decide what to do with them, and it forms the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and it's exactly what is done on a large scale to manipulate people. Mm-hmm. Is you're manipulating elements of the environment around to create paths and to canalize where what people have to do in order to function in the system. It's mm-hmm. the exact same thing. I've studied a decent amount of like military psyops.
Mm-hmm.
That's essential reading for anybody that wants to understand, you know, the systems of domination. They have manuals on how they do it. You know, you can go download the manuals and read them. And it's, of course, it's all, no, we do this in other countries, not domestically, but it's the exact same tactics they use domestically. And it's all about what you're saying, all about figuring out what groups to use against each other and just getting things started and walking away. You know, it's the same thing with the agent provocateur, the NSA internet trolls and everything like that. I mean, they only need a small amount of those people. If you affect other people with your bullshit and basically get them to spread it for you and get them to go online and fight, you know, for you, like what they're doing, I mean, it's like the wasp and the worms. You know, you're getting the, you know, you're not doing anything other than just setting up the conditions, and maybe, you know, I'm giving the wasp the idea that, hey, there's food here for you. You know,
yeah.
Here, go get it, you know. That's what I thrive on, is making those connections, and that's one that I've made in the past. And, you know, you could make so many other connections that would all intersect with that, too, with so many other things, definitely.
Well, the work that you're doing is also very much like this lever, right, that has all of these residual benefits. I mean, first and foremost, you're surviving. And it's taking care of, you know, those most basic needs a husband and wife or that a family or that an individual would have, for sure, without anybody else being involved, which addresses all of these other motivations like autonomy, predictability, and feeling effective and feeling good and satisfied in what you do. But the residuals are also very much like addressing and finding a way around these domination systems that we've been speaking about, that some people see themselves as actually engaged in battle with. But I don't like to think about it that way. And you know, all of this is something that's happening outside of that, as an alternative to that. And as most importantly to me and what we do on this show, as an alternative to dependence, because being dependent means being under control. So that's what's so exciting and inspiring about this for me.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, as far as the battle analogy goes, I don't really see it as not a battle, but I think the battle is just happening in people's minds. I seek to give people ammunition,
mm-hmm.
you know, to use in that battle. And I don't really see it as a struggle against external forces as much as it's a struggle against bad philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe a struggle is a better way of terming it than a battle.
Right.
And of course, that's, you know, in the religious context, that's how it's termed in most of the Abrahamic religions, like the concept of jihad is the struggle, and there's the struggle in Christianity, and in Judaism, there's the struggle against the animal and the spiritual self. But I guess it's more of a struggle, and it's a struggle against bad philosophy. I think the whole, you know, physical battle thing kind of fades away a little bit.
Absolutely. Why don't we leave it there for today? When we pick up again, I would love
for you to go through your whole learning process. We can dedicate a show to that from the very beginning, you know, how you guys got into this, where you started, how it evolved, and where you are now, which we've already covered a little bit, but I would certainly like to hear the whole story, because one of the things that I want to be able to offer to people is, well, you know, the people listen and the question they might have, if the situation allows or if their circumstances allow, is how could I do this? So yeah. I think that, you know, you going through your whole process, starting in a very different place from where you are now, might provide people some answers.
Yeah, definitely, because we've kind of run the gamut of situation to try this end. And this is maybe our end destination, maybe not, but we've done everything from the small urban front yard, which is, you know, maybe 10 by 10 feet, to now we have a 12.5-acre homestead.
Yeah.
We've done everything in between, so.
Great. Then that's where we'll pick up next time.
All right. Thanks, Brett.
1, 2, 3. You'll see, life can be quite comparative.